Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So we're looking at Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 47, the Vimamsaka Sutta, or the Inquirer. And we're trying to record the questions as well as the teaching. So if anyone wants to ask a question, we have a mobile microphone, which Bo will bring round to you so that we can record the questions as well. No questions so far? So this sutta is entitled The Inquirer, and another place where we meet Vimamsaka as a quality or as something that we need to cultivate is in the four Iddhipadas, the four roads to success. Vimamsa is one of the qualities of the Iddhipadas. And the Iddhipadas are chanda, which is zeal or enthusiasm or wholesome desire to practice the path and realize the goal. Virya, energy, is the energy and the effort and the patient persistence to realize the goal. Citta is the application of the mind to realize the goal and to keep the goal in mind and to apply the mind to what needs to be done in order to realize the goal. And Vimamsa is the fourth quality, and that's the quality of inquiring into the Dharma. And this has both the aspect of inquiring into the teachings, but also inquiring into the nature of reality. And it's that attitude of continually inquiring and being investigating and inspecting that brings success in the path. That is actually what we're doing with the enthusiasm and the energy that we are generating. We're inquiring into reality. So this spirit of inquiry is one which is very much encouraged in the Buddha's teachings, not to have blind faith and to accept things just because we like the sound of them or we agree with them, but to inquire into things for ourselves. And in this particular sutta today, the Buddha is encouraging his disciples or potential disciples to encourage into, to inquire into the teacher himself, to see whether the teacher is actually worth following, listening to. Is the teacher expressing in his own behaviour what he's talking about in his teachings? And this is particularly about investigating the Buddha as the teacher. But this spirit of inquiry is something that we should continue in even today when we have teachers that we are listening to and following. We should inspect their behaviour and see whether their behaviour is in accordance with the teaching. Because the sutta goes on to say that when one has confidence in the teacher, then one is more likely to actually listen to the teaching and to put the teaching into practice and to find out for oneself whether or not the teaching is true. And we know this from our own experience that we're very often attracted to the teaching because we like the people who are teaching. We are inspired by them, or we see some quality in them that we'd like to emulate or that we'd like to have in our own life. And so the attraction of the teacher is one of the things that very often brings us into contact with the teaching. And it can be counterproductive if we lose faith in the teacher because they're not living up to the standard that we expect, and we turn our back on the teaching, which can actually be very worthwhile and have something valuable to say to us. So how we react to the teacher and the example that the teacher gives to us is very important. So in this sutta, we're going to look at how the Buddha encouraged his disciples in the time when he was with them to examine him and to find out for themselves whether they should follow him as the enlightened one. So we'll start reading through, and if you have any questions, please stop me. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Natapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is an inquirer, not knowing how to gauge another's mind, should make an investigation of the Tathagata in order to find out whether or not he is fully enlightened." This not knowing how to gauge another's mind is saying that this person wants to find out whether the Buddha is enlightened, and because that person is not themselves enlightened or proficient in any psychic powers, they can't actually look into the mind of the Buddha or to another person. They can't actually know what that other person's mind is like. So how are they going to actually find out whether they think that the Buddha is enlightened or that he is worthy of following? And we'll go on and see how the Buddha says, if you can't read the person's mind, this is how you can work out whether they're enlightened. Venerable Sir, verse 4, Venerable Sir, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One. Have the Blessed One as their resort. It will be good if the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then listen, bhikkhus, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is an inquirer, not knowing how to gauge another's mind, should investigate the Tathagata with respect to two kinds of states, states cognizable through the eye and through the ear, thus. Are there found in the Tathagata or not any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? When he investigates him, he comes to know. No defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. So the Tathagata is the way that the Buddha used to refer to himself, the one who has gone to the goal of the path to enlightenment, to freedom. And what he's saying is that if you don't know how to read another's mind, then look at their behaviour, that is, states cognizable through the eye. What do you see that they're doing? And also look at their what is cognizable through the ear, how they speak their words. So the Buddha's saying if you can't read the person's mind, watch their behaviour and listen to what they say. And when you investigate, it comes to know. no defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. So by watching the Buddha, one can see that through his behavior and in his speech, he doesn't express anything that one would say was coming from greed, hatred, or delusion.
Ajahn, the question I'd like to ask is, you said the Buddha refers to himself as the Tathagata, which is in the second person. Is that because he's attained the attainment of non-self, that he refers to himself as thee rather than me or I?
Yes, the way that the Buddha referred to himself usually was in the third person. I guess you could say it's a compromise between the absolute truth, which he knew to be that there was actually no being, or no person who could be called the Buddha, but simply a process. So that was the realization of non-self. But in conventional speech and in conventional reality, there has to be a label that we use or that we apply to things just to engage in normal interaction. So the Buddha used this description of himself as the Tathagata to, bring together that absolute reality or truth with the conventional reality.
Thank you, Ajahn.
So we're up to verse 5. This, he investigates him further. Thus, are they found in the Tathagata or not any mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? When he investigates him, he comes to know no mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. And the commentary has a good definition of the mixed states. They refer to the conduct of one who is engaged in purifying his conduct but is unable to keep to it consistently. Sometimes his conduct is pure or bright, sometimes impure or dark. So those of us still not fully realise the goal yet, we still have greed, hatred and delusion. And most of the time we may be able to keep that greed and hatred under wraps, at least not in our actions and our speech, but at times, if conditions are right, that greed and hatred will reveal itself in our speech and our behaviour. We're able to be seen by others. It doesn't just stay in our own mind. And so these would be the mixed states. And so when the person examines and inquires into the Buddha's behaviour and speech, they find that there isn't any time when the Buddha has greed or hatred or delusion acting in his mind. It doesn't show in his speech or his behaviour. Verse 6, when he comes to know this, he investigates him further. Thus, are they found in the Tathagata or not cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? When he investigates him, he comes to know cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. So the cleansed states would be those wholesome states which exhibit themselves again and again. The loving kindness, compassion, patience, all of those things, energetic effort, those very wholesome states that one sees. And one can imagine also that if one is looking to inquire into the behaviour of the teacher, that one might look at situations that we find challenging to be in, and then we find that we imagine we would react in a certain way in that situation. under some stress or difficulty, and then we observe how does the teacher behave in those situations, and we find that their behaviour is quite different to what we'd be doing if we had to cope with that. And so then we can just infer from that that there's some cleansing has taken place from our particular frame of mind as we would be to where the teacher is right now, the way that they are behaving or reacting. And so it's also through making these sort of deductions about how we would behave and then how, in given the conditions, it's likely that most people would behave, and then seeing that the teacher is behaving otherwise. This is a way that we can assume that these cleansed states are being exhibited. Verse 7, when he comes to know this, he investigates him further thus. Has this Venerable One attained this wholesome state over a long time, or did he attain it recently? When he investigates him, he comes to know. This Venerable One has attained this wholesome state over a long time. He did not attain it only recently. So again, these are things which we would be discovering through observing someone, hearing their story, letting them, hearing their reflections on how they've achieved the state that they've achieved. These are things which we can't know directly through knowing that person's mind, but all of the investigation that we do around that person, and perhaps talking to other people who remember that person from a long time ago and how they've always been this way, or that they've changed over the time that they've known them. So this is just talking about the general kinds of inquiries that we make to find out, is this person for real or not? Verse 8, when he comes to know this, he investigates him further. Has this Venerable One acquired renown and attained fame, so that the dangers connected with renown and fame are found in him? For bhikkhus, as long as a bhikkhu has not acquired renown and attained fame, the dangers connected with renown and fame are not found in him. But when he has acquired renown and attained fame, those dangers are found in him. And the dangers which the commentary mentions, the dangers are conceit and arrogance, for example. For some bhikkhus, as long as they have not become well known or acquired a following, these dangers are not found and they are very calm and quiet. But when they have become famous and have acquired a following, they go about behaving improperly, attacking other bhikkhus like a leopard pouncing on a herd of deer. And this is actually one point that we don't immediately think of when we think about the dangers of fear renown and fame, is that when someone starts to become well-known and they acquire a following and they acquire some power, that there is sometimes a tendency then to denigrate other teachers. And this is a very nice simile, this leopard pouncing on a herd of deer, that once you become powerful enough to have your voice heard or to make a statement, that you actually denigrate others who aren't the same as you or in the same league as you or whatever. So this is what the Buddha's encouraging this person to investigate. When someone becomes famous and it acquires renown, how do they behave then compared to how they behaved when they weren't so famous? And when he investigates him, he comes to know this venerable one has acquired renown and attained fame, but the dangers connected with renown and fame are not found in him. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further, thus, is this Venerable One restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, And does he avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? When he investigates him further, he comes to know this venerable one is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear. And he avoids indulging in sensual pleasure because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. And I feel I found that sentence, restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, quite a powerful sentence just to contemplate on the difference between being restrained by fear and so thinking about not saying things that will upset people or not saying things that might lose support, particularly if we're thinking about those teachers who have renown and fame, that there's a tendency to try to protect one's position and not wanting to do things that people might criticise because we don't want to make a bad impression, for example. But if we're restrained without fear, then there's not this kind of gauging what will people think or how will this look or what will be the result of this in people's eyes. There's a sense of freedom of just intuitively knowing what is appropriate and what is not, what's wholesome and what's not wholesome, what's skillful and what's not skillful. And so there's a restraint which comes not through fear but through wisdom, and then one is restrained without fear, and one does not restrain oneself from indulging in sensual pleasures because you can't or because someone might find out or might look bad, but because there is no lust for sensual pleasures. That lust for sensual pleasures has been completely destroyed. So one investigates to see by observing, by listening to, by seeing this person, the teacher, in various situations, dealing with different kinds of people, with different demands on them, just how this person behaves. Verse 10, now bhikkhus, if others should ask that bhikkhu thus, what are the venerable one's reasons and what is his evidence whereby he says that venerable one is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and he avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? Answering rightly, that bhikkhu would answer thus, whether that venerable one dwells in the Sangha or alone, while some here are well behaved and some are ill behaved, and some here teach a group, while some here are seen concerned with material things and some are unsullied by material things, still that venerable one does not despise anyone because of that. And I have heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. I am restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and I avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because I am without lust through the destruction of lust. So the Buddha is saying that you should see what this person is like when they're in a group, when they're in public, and when they're in a situation where they're not in public, when they're alone with the people that they feel comfortable with, what is their behaviour like then? Whether they dwell in seclusion and are not teaching in a group or living in a group, or whether they are associated with the group and teaching with the group, living with the group, what is their behaviour? And when other people are behaving badly, how do they react then? Do they look down on those who are behaving badly? Do they look down on those who are not in the same league of influence or category of renown that they are? How do they behave in those situations? So this is a way that one can get to know this person, not just on the public face, but also the more private face in any different situation. And the commentary on this, with the Buddha talking about, does the Venerable despise anyone who's different, those who aren't behaving well, or those who are overly concerned with material things? And the Buddha is saying that he looks on all of these people with impartiality, that he doesn't despise or look down on anyone else, that even when he sees that people are behaving badly, he still doesn't criticise and look down on them. Verse 11, the Tathagata bhikkhus should be questioned further about that. Thus, are there found in the Tathagata or not defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? The Tathagata would answer thus, no defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. So first we had the disciple or potential disciple observing the Tathagata, the Buddha, and seeing what he could find out for himself. And now from verse 11, the Buddha is saying, if he asked me directly, were there any defiled states present in me, I would answer him directly, no defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. If asked, are there found in the Tathagata or not any mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear, the Tathagata would answer thus, no mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. And if asked, are there found in the Tathagata or not cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear, the Tathagata would answer thus, cleansed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear are found in the Tathagata. They are my pathway and my domain, yet I do not identify with them. And this again is another very powerful statement I find from the Buddha. He says that these cleansed states are found in him and they are his dwelling place basically, but he doesn't identify with them as I'm that wonderful person, I'm that pure person, and he doesn't have any craving or clinging to those states. The commentary says, and a way of translating that is, I do not identify with that purified virtue. I am without craving for it. So it's not that it's something that the Buddha is holding up as his shining star, the thing that he has achieved. It simply is. It simply is because of his purity. And it's where he, his pathway, his way of receiving the world and interacting with the world, going out into the world, and also the way that he lives his life. And it's his domain. It's simply where he spends his time, basically, in this purified state. So, but yet I do not identify with them. And I'd just like to refer to another passage that appears in the Anguttara Nikaya. This is in the Book of the Sevens. It's reading number 55 in the Book of the Sevens of the Anguttara Nikaya. And in Bhikkhu Bodhi's version, it's subtitled No Need for Concealment. And this is where the Buddha is referring to this purified conduct which he has by virtue of his attainment of enlightenment. And I'll just read the whole passage. "There are, O monks, these four things that the Tathagata has no need to conceal, and three ways in which he is irreproachable. And what, monks, are the four things that the Tathagata has no need to conceal? The Tathagata's bodily conduct is purified. There is no bodily misconduct on the part of the Tathagata that he might need to conceal, thinking, let others not find out about this. The Tathagata's verbal conduct is purified. His mental conduct is purified. His livelihood is purified. There is no wrong livelihood on the part of the Tathagata that he might need to conceal, thinking, let others not find out this about this. These, monks, are the four things that the Tathagata has no need to conceal. And what are the three ways in which he is irreproachable? The Dharma, monks, has been well expounded by the Tathagata. I do not see any ground on which an ascetic or Brahman or Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world might reasonably reproach me, saying, for such a reason your Dharma is not well expounded. Since I do not see any ground, any such ground, I dwell secure, fearless and self-confident. The way leading to Nibbana has been well proclaimed by me to my disciples, so that my disciples who practice accordingly by the destruction of the taints in this very life enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of the mind, liberation by wisdom, having realized it for themselves by direct knowledge. I do not see any ground on which an ascetic or anyone in the world might reasonably reproach me, saying, for such a reason, the way leading to Nibbana has not been well proclaimed by you. Since I do not see any such ground, I dwell secure, fearless and self-confident. Many hundreds of disciples in my assembly, by the destruction of the taints in this very life, enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, having realized it for themselves by direct knowledge. I do not see any ground on which an ascetic or anyone in the world might reasonably reproach me, saying, for such a reason, it is not true that many hundreds of disciples in your assembly enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, having realized it for themselves by direct knowledge. Since I do not see any such ground, I dwell secure, fearless, and self-confident. These, monks, are the three ways in which I am irreproachable. These, monks, are the four things that the Tathagata has no need to conceal, and the three ways in which he is irreproachable." So the Buddha in that statement is declaring that he's fearless because he knows that he is irreproachable in his own conduct and also in his teaching, that the teaching that he is given is a teaching which, if followed and practiced, leads to liberation. And so because of that, he is fearless and self-confident. And so this echoes the being restrained without fear rather than being restrained by fear, avoiding indulging in sensual pleasures because it's without lust, through the destruction of lust for sensual pleasures. With that sure knowledge, the Buddha is confident in any situation, in any assembly, in any way that anyone can examine him. His behaviour or his teaching, he is confident. Yet I do not identify with any of that, says the Buddha. So verse 14, bhikkhus, a disciple should approach the teacher who speaks thus in order to hear the Dharma. And this is where we come back to the original point I was making, that when someone is looking at a teacher, wanting to know what they teach, very often the way that we investigate the teaching is through the quality of the teacher and seeing whether they exhibit behaviours that we admire and if we appreciate them, and if their teaching seems to be something that leads in the direction we want to go. And so the Buddha is saying, because the disciple should approach the teacher who speaks thus in order to hear the Dharma. So being convinced through seeing the teacher, then the disciple approaches wanting to hear what the teacher has to say. The teacher teaches him the Dharma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. Its dark and bright counterparts can be taken to mean that in this path there are those things which should be cultivated and there are those things which should be let go of. So there is the cultivation and development of wholesome qualities and there is the restraining and refraining from unwholesome qualities. So the dark is the unwholesome that we're trying to let go of and overcome, and the bright is the wholesome that we're trying to develop. As the teacher teaches the Dharma to a bhikkhu in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dharma, the bhikkhu comes to a conclusion about the teachings. He places confidence in the teacher thus: the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing well. So the disciple, through hearing the teaching and putting it into practice, comes to direct knowledge of a certain teaching. He may not know the whole of the teaching directly, but through his direct experience of that aspect of the Dharma, he gains confidence that the teacher does know what they're talking about. This Dharma is well proclaimed. If one practices this teaching, it's possible to realise the results. And so then one great confidence arises in the teacher, in the teaching, and in the Sangha that is practising in the good way. And the commentary says, when it's talking about the teacher, when the Dharma has been taught by the teacher, by directly knowing the Dharma through penetration of path, root and nibbana, bhikkhu comes to a conclusion about the preliminary teachings of the Dharma on the requisites of enlightenment. So basically what the commentary is saying, that when the disciple has a taste of the truth of the teaching in one aspect of it, then the confidence grows that whatever the Buddha has given as the preliminary practices or as the other aspects in order to develop the path further, that is the truth and that is worth pursuing, because one has confidence in the whole of the teaching that the Buddha has given. Verse 15, now if others should ask that bhikkhu thus, what are the Venerable One's reasons and what is his evidence whereby he says, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way? Answering rightly, that bhikkhu would answer thus, here, friends, I approached the Blessed One in order to hear the Dharma. The Blessed One taught me the Dharma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. As the Blessed One taught the Dharma to me in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dharma, I came to a conclusion about the teachings. I placed confidence in the teacher thus, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, The Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Now, the Buddha says, because when anyone's faith has been planted, rooted and established in the Tathagata through these reasons, terms and phrases, his faith is said to be supported by reasons rooted in vision, firm. It is invincible by any recluse or Brahman or God or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world. That is how bhikkhus, there is investigation of the Tathagata in accordance with Dharma, and that is how the Tathagata is well investigated in accordance with Dharma. So what the Buddha is referring to when he says that the faith has been planted and rooted and established in the Tathagata, and that this faith is now firm and rooted in vision, it's invincible, is that this person through practicing has become a stream winner at least and has tasted the Dharma, the truth of the Dharma for themselves. And at that point we say that the person who's entered on the path to Nibbana, becoming a stream enterer, has seen for themselves through their direct experience, through their direct insight, the truth of the teaching, and particularly the truth of impermanence, non-self or conditionality, everything arising out of causes and conditions, and penetrating to the truth of unsatisfactoriness or dukkha in everything that's of conditional nature, of an impermanent nature. And one has seen for oneself that there is no self-existing, independent person, a self that exists apart from causes and conditions. So the personality view, the idea that I am this body or I am this mind, and there is something inherently me in all of this that comprises this mind and this body, this is seen through. And so there's an understanding, an experiential understanding of non-self. Also at the time of stream winning, there's, because one has tasted the truth for oneself, there is no doubt that the Buddha's teaching is accurate, and that it's not only an accurate description of reality, but that it is the blueprint for practicing for one's complete liberation, and that one can no longer or can never take another teacher except the Buddha, because one realizes that this teacher knows what they're talking about and can provide the instructions needed so that we can follow ourselves on that path. The other fetter that goes at stream winning is that one no longer believes that through any kind of rite or ritual that one can attain enlightenment, that alone will free one from the cycle of samsara. One knows that it has to be done through the mind, through the liberation of the mind, through wisdom. And so because one knows these things for oneself, then one's confidence in the teacher and confidence in the Dharma and feeling that the Sangha is practicing in the right way, if they're practicing according to the instructions of the Buddha, then this is an invincible confidence. And then the Buddha goes on to say, that is what the Blessed One said, and the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, are there any questions?
I find
we just have a question. If we could just have it into the microphone, please.
But ill-behaved. That must be the most difficult one, I would have thought, for nuns and monks to deal with the lay people when they see them not behaving in the correct way in many different ways. It must be difficult for them. Whereas I find most of the others, well, yeah, that can be sort of okay, fairly easy to deal with. Do you agree with that?
Do you mean it's difficult when the lay people are ill-behaved or when the Sangha is ill-behaved?
Well, when the lay people are ill-behaved, whether it's speech, body, or anything else, it must be one of the most difficult for you to deal with that in your minds.
So the question about dealing with ill-behaved people, do you mean it was difficult not to criticise them?
Your mind, yes, you must be thinking, you know, sometimes, whatever.
In the mind, yes. This is the difference between the Buddha and an unenlightened person who's seeing behaviour that's unskillful. But I think that the more that you understand the teaching and the more exposure and experience you have to various ways in which our ignorance overcomes us and we act in foolish ways, It becomes easier most of the time. I'm speaking just for myself, not for anyone else, to see that ill-behaved people are ignorant and acting out of ignorance. And because basically what comes presents itself very often is people doing things which cause themselves harm, and which have caused themselves harm in the past, and yet they're repeating it. And no one would do that unless they were really foolish.
I was sort of thinking, well, you say something, well, a lot of these things over and over again to us, so it's not that we don't know about it, and yet you must say to yourself, you know, said this so many times, not to do this, not to speak like this or whatever, and yet they're still doing it.
Yes, that the idea that you repeat the same sort of instructions and people continue to ignore them, I think it's one of the things that assist in accepting that in people is to watch our own behaviour and realise how many times we try to do something differently or better than the last time and find it's hard to do it because habit patterns or defilements are strong in the mind personally. And so by seeing that in ourselves, it's easier to understand it in others and not to condemn. And as I said, when you see sometimes people are coming and telling you the same thing over and over again as a source of suffering, and you can see that they, if they could do it differently, they would, because it's painful what they're doing to themselves. And so, you know, that strong understanding that this is delusion, this is our ignorance, this is why we can't see how we hurt ourselves. And we can't then do something differently because we still haven't seen clearly.
Ajahn, I had an experience yesterday, and it was regarding, I was said to be saying something that was quite offensive, and I know it was not appropriate, what I was being accused of, and I felt all I could do was just stay in silence and just feel pity for that person and just give that loving kindness. Could that have been the right behaviour in response to what was being said?
So the question about being silent in response to someone's unskillful speech, sometimes that is the only response. It is skillful not to say anything in return. You use the word pity for that person, and just from a strictly theoretical point of view, we would say that rather than pity, which seems to separate us from that person, that person's doing something that we would never do, the way that we would, the Buddha describes the responses most skillful is compassion, which sees that we could be in that person's shoes doing the same unskillful thing. There's a potential for that in us as well, through our own wisdom or understanding or restraint. We're not acting in that way at the moment, but there is an understanding that we have this potential to be just as foolish. And so there's not such a separation between us and them, but that's just a minor point. To not respond in kind to them is a skillful thing, and to respond without saying anything, if that's may be the most appropriate thing, or maybe all that we can do at the time.
So many. My question was, how long should you observe a teacher before you decide to put your trust in a teacher? I know from my own personal professional background, many people have a mentality of trust or no trust, and it's like flicking a switch, and they oscillate between these two. I wonder if you could say something about the development of how one goes about developing trust in a teacher. The Buddha says, take some time. My question is, how long and what sort of tests or things would you be looking at when you're looking to take refuge in a teacher?
So the question about how long should you observe a teacher before you put your trust in them is like saying how long is a piece of string, I suppose. It's very individual. Depends, as you said, on your own nature too, whether you're a person who very easily trusts others or someone who's perhaps through experience learnt to be more reserved and even cynical about people, that you don't take them on face value. So I think that's actually one of the conditions, is how well we know ourselves and how well we know our tendencies to judge another person.
You can prematurely fall into a state of trust with people. I mean, I know professionally from my work, people oscillate, especially people that have had difficulties in interpersonal difficulties in the past. They oscillate between trust and no trust. So I'm not going to trust anybody, and then suddenly I'll just trust them with my life. And so you can get into that situation where a person can prematurely trust another person, or in this case, a teacher.
So I guess if we can just limit it to people who are fairly mentally stable and able to be confident in their decisions about trusting or not trusting, so not someone who's swinging dramatically from not trusting anyone to then trusting everyone, but just the normal person. It will depend on our history with people and whether we've been hurt by people that we've trusted and who haven't been worthy of that trust. I think the surest way for us to know personally is how we feel, and to let our heart really be our guide. So more than the words that we say, or what appears to be the external conditions, everyone else believes them, or gee, they can do these wonderful things, is what our heart tells us. Because even if we go along and give trust when we don't really feel it, then it will be an uneasy relationship. So I think we have to trust our heart, and I think there is a point at which we feel that we can trust someone. And then for the person who's being trusted, if it's a teacher, then one of the ways that we would look at whether a teacher is worthy of our trust is, how do they respond to favourable or unfavourable comments that people make? Are they able to receive those without losing the balance of their own mind? and to be fairly equanimous with people's criticisms, or when people who are very enthusiastic stop being very enthusiastic. So how is their own, the teacher's level of equanimity in the ups and downs of the teacher-student situation? So if we were observing the teacher, that's one of the things that we would, I guess, look at, and then judge according to how it makes us feel in our own heart.
Thanks.
But since I am delusioned, the sutta says that I'm supposed to observe and see if the teacher is talking without delusion. But if my feelings are delusioned, if I am delusioned, how am I supposed to know if a teacher speaks without delusion?
Yes, so that's a very good question. How are you supposed to know that the teacher's speaking without delusion if you have a delusion yourself? And that's why you have to go back to your gut feeling. That's what I'm suggesting, that you have to trust, because your delusion will be your individual delusion based on your past experiences and the way that you feel about things and how you interpret what the teacher is doing and how you respond to other people who are trusting the teacher, who you admire, you know, you're influenced by them or you're put off by them. So it will be a very personal situation. And I think then you have to go back to just not closing your mind to another possibility, but going at the pace that you feel comfortable to go at.
So is my deepest feeling always right?
No, is your deepest feeling always right? Right in what sense? It may be what you feel at that moment, but whether it's truth, no. Absolute truth, definitely not, because it's conditioned. It's the result of your past experiences and what's happening to you and your level of understanding and all of those things. But it's true for you at that time, so I don't think that you should dismiss it out of hand. But you shouldn't, what we try to do is to keep an open mind, that it's not necessarily the whole story, it's not necessarily permanently the story, it's not the absolute truth. And so we don't deny it, but we leave room for learning something different.
Thanks.
Quite a straightforward sutta, but I think quite important, and also because it gives us some guidelines for what we often encounter in our situation when new teachers come along, and they might be teaching something that's different to what we've heard before, or it might complement what we've already heard, and we're interested to take the teaching that they have to offer. So it's quite relevant for our situation, but it also shows the wonder of the Buddha, who encouraged people to investigate him and examine him, not to take anything on face value, but to find out for themselves. So if there are no more questions, then we'll just end by the sharing of merits. So as I chant the sharing of merit, please just take this as for your own effort in being here and your own aspiration to purify the mind and realize the truth of the teaching, that you also make this sharing of merits. May the merits made by me, now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable. By rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me, may beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you.